Well, welcome everybody. I think many of you are the same faces I saw yesterday, but if you were not, my name is Pauline Laudicus, and it's my pleasure to introduce the speakers for today's two talks, our last in this series of the anniversary of the System Gun. So Anne, Neil, very great welcome back to the University of Melbourne. We're really pleased you could be here. Anne is a cultural historian with many degrees in architecture, architectural history and art history from the University of Melbourne. After many years in Melbourne and overseas, Anne moved back to Launceston, which I gather is your hometown, home city, and there you taught design history for the University of Tasmania, and I believe it was considered the best course of its type in Australia. Anne has published extensively on architectural and garden history. She's served on various advisory planning and heritage committees, including for the City of Launceston. And she is a well-known and very popular speaker, so we're really looking forward to hearing your talk today on the System Garden, its design and designer. Welcome, Anne.
Good morning, and I would like to say thank you to the organisers of this event for inviting me to come over from Tasmania and speak. Just before I start, I'd like to acknowledge that there were three people involved in doing the research on the history of the System Garden, or the Botanic Garden it was originally known. The late George Tibbetts, who some of you will know did reports on many of the historic buildings and sites in the university, and Gwen Pascoe, Gwen had the knowledge both in horticulture and in history. Now I'll just rush to say, don't ask me a botanical question, anything to do with plants, sorry, really don't know, so you might have to get Pauline to field those sort. Right, let's see if we go. Yes. Okay, so just to set the scene, the university grounds, the design was first commissioned in 1855 from a man called Edward Latrobe Bateman. Now, towards the end of this presentation, I'll tell you more about him. But what you can see in the plan here is the sort of reconstruction I made based on all the available sources we could find. For his design for the university, starting in 1855, and then it was modified, but this shows it as it was in about, or intended to be in about 1864. So you can see Tin Alley at the top there, the central axis going up to the quadrangle from Grattan Street here, the System Garden here, and then the other elements, the National Museum, as it was, which you can see there in relation to the quadrangle buildings, the medical school from the 1860s there, and the lake, which was filled in approximately the 1930s when chemistry was built, and this area now is what we know as the concrete lawns. Yeah. Now, one of the things you certainly can't miss in this diagram is these radiating avenues. And in landscaping terms, that's known as a patois, or goose foot arrangement from the French. And the thing was that at the time the university was placed on this site, it was really just floating in, semi-wilderness with some housing. And so to really locate it, what happened was that Bateman made the decision that from the quadrangle, in front of the quadrangle, you would have these vistas. And so this one here eventually would take your eye to the Benevolent Asylum in North Melbourne as a landmark. This one on this side would go out to Scott's Church in the city as another landmark. And this axis, which had already been established, of course, went straight down into the city centre. And you can see there quite extraordinary planting Now, Bateman was fascinated by native plants of the Australasian region and used them wherever he could. And so, because many of you are botanists and tree people, and I knew you'd ask, I actually carefully wrote down what they were. Excuse me for my pronunciation. But basically, on each side of that central avenue, you have five staggered rows of trees, which consisted of Ficus macrophylla, the Moreton Bay fig, Araucaria heterophylla, Norfolk Island pine, Grevillea robusta, the silky oak, and Melia azadaric australasica, white cedar, and various Pittosporum species. So it must have been quite an extraordinary sight. Okay, now the other aspects of like the wavy sort of paths undulating around the perimeter is characteristic of Bateman's park designs, and the way that they're quite heavily planted around the border and at key junctions in pathways, but then much more open areas. And the idea was that the larger grounds would also serve as a sort of botanic garden, not a systematic botanic garden. But the idea was that there were going to also be avenues running east and west, and then in the segments created, you would group trees and shrubs according to their geographical origin. I'm not sure that ever happened, but that was the intention. Okay, so to move on to the system garden itself. Now, this was an illustration based on a site plan done by the Properties and Buildings people of the university in 1994. And then overlaid on that, you can see this is the line of the enclosing hedge of the garden. That is the tower of the conservatory, which still exists there at the centre. The conservatory, which is this octagonal building, set on an island effectively because there was what they called the water circle around it. But the most interesting thing for this is to get some sense of the extent of the garden when it was, you know, between 3 and 4 acres in extent. So outside the hedge there was a sort of shelter bank, and that was planted as well. And then a road that you can see here that went right around the outside. Now, almost the only place you can pick up the outer curve of the system garden anymore is in the path in front of old agriculture. That curved path is on the line of the roadway that went right around the outer perimeter over near to University House there, Professor's Walk, and back around. Now, part of the reason that George Tibbetts got this plan made was, of course, we were trying to establish which of the surviving plants in the garden may have been there from the 1850s, 1860s onwards. And I'll talk about that in a little more detail shortly. Now, here we see the earliest photograph we have of the system garden. This photograph is taken from the northwest axis, so north up on the plan, and the northwest axis was sort of the working axis of the garden. So a tool house, potting shed, greenhouse, glass frames, propagating pit, all that sort of thing were up in this corner. And so anybody working in the garden accessed it through this northwest axis. Students and visitors accessed it through a gate in the southern boundary. As you can see in this view of 1865, this is before the conservatory has been built, and you can just make out what I think is probably a standpipe, a water supply standpipe, in the very centre of the garden there. If you look carefully, you'll see this chap here, looking very African with his pith helmet on, is standing there with a sort of pump arrangement. So clearly they were still effectively having to hand water, and for an area of 4 acres, that was very demanding work indeed. In the background there, you can see the quadrangle buildings, and over on the left, the National Museum, on the site of what's now the Union Building. Now, when we did the study, Gwen Pascoe, as the horticultural expert, was challenged with trying to work out what was the system behind the system garden. Now, some of you may have heard her speak on Sunday. She very modestly glossed over the fact that I think over the course of 6 months she must have examined every system of botanical classification known to man by the 19th century. And what she was trying to do was cross-reference, you know, the illustrations we have, the plan, a plant list, which was compiled in 1864 of the plants in the garden, and what was still surviving with the various systems that were then being explored. It was only at the very last minute that she finally stumbled on the right system, and that was one by J.H. Balfour. Now, what she was then able to do was to match up all the available information. One of the interesting things we came across while we were investigating the different classification systems at the time was there was considerable debate going on about whether it should be a linear system or a circular system. Now, to be honest with you, I don't fully understand the implications of that, but in design terms, the fact that such eminent people as the Hookers at Kew were beginning to favour a circular system may well have been the reason that having a circular system garden was first thought about. Now, that diagram there shows you Gwen Pascoe's analysis of being able to link up the beds with Balfour's system. So, as I say, as a student or a visitor, you entered by the south gate, and first order was started at this point. You then went anti-clockwise around, and then when you got back to the southern axis, you moved in a circle, and then you went round anti-clockwise again, and so on as you got closer to the centre of the garden. Now, this view here was taken in the 1880s. As I said, we only have four views of the garden from the 19th century. And you can just pick up that's what's now University House in the background. So we're looking across the northern part of the system garden in that view. Now, as always, when you're talking about things within the university system, it comes down to funding and politics. And I can talk about this because I'm not part of the institution anymore. Professor McCoy, who was responsible for getting the garden made and was very proud of it, saw it as being very much his baby, right from the start intended to have a conservatory at the centre of the garden. But the problem was there wasn't the money to do it. And he battled with getting funding for enough gardeners, for really anything to do with the garden, until in the end, I'd like to say that in a way he gave up, but I think the university gave up on the system garden. And by the early 20th century, it was pretty well derelict. However, going back to its heyday, what these two photographs show us, the upper one from about 1873, the lower one from the mid-1880s, is the conservatory. And by going through all the university records, we were able to determine, you know, exactly when he got the funding for a bit. And so he would do a bit each time. But occasionally he sort of got a bit fed up with that. So I don't know if you can make out the numbers here, but basically the first section he did was this one here. So there's that northwestern axis. So the first bit he did was that bit there, effectively. But it had a sort of less extensive brim, you might say, to the glass hat of the conservatory. And then, you know, a little bit later, he got money to do a second segment, so did that again with the smaller brim. Now, the third grant he got was not enough to do two full sectors, but more than he needed for one sector. So he had a bit of a brainwave and decided, right, he'd extend the brim of the dome for both the existing sections and the new section, and that from then on it would be built to that extended profile. The thing was that somewhere along the line he didn't actually bother getting university approval for this. He just went to the architects, told them to get tenders, they got tenders, the thing got built, and then the university was presented with the bill. So, and this was sort of characteristic of the man, that, you know, if all else fails, we'll just, you know, crash through. So it was always a battle between him and the university. But just while we have this diagram up, you can see that this is the central tower that still exists. Now, currently it only has two doors and two windows, but initially it had a doorway in each of what you might refer to as the corners. And these dotted lines here show what we believe were walls that were put in, partly because, as you can see here, being constructed in parts, of course, you had to have walls to enclose temporarily the structure that had been built so far. But also we think so that they could treat zones of the conservatory differently in terms of ventilation and so on, because of course, in terms of the sunlight it was getting, it was going to behave differently and you'd have different sort of plants in it. And so they sort of started with this area facing north, which of course is always easiest to manage in terms of sunlight and shading. Then this next section facing east and southeast, which again, you know, relatively manageable, doesn't get too hot. And then the last segment here was always going to be tricky, I think, in terms of management, because it was the two extremes. It faced south and west, and so you had the least sun and the hottest, lowest sun coming into the same sector. How it was managed in terms of ventilation, you need to understand that this tower was it's not just a sort of ornamental folly. It was crucial to the whole design. First of all, ideally they would have built a circular conservatory. That would have worked best, but they knew from the start they weren't going to get money for that, because with a circular conservatory you have to build it all at once. You can't do it in stages. But by having the octagonal tower, you could build in segments as it happened. Now, this tower, it doesn't make sense today because there's a ceiling in underneath those roof vents that you can see there. But it acted as basically a chimney stack. So that what would happen is, you can probably just make out, maybe in that lower view or maybe up there, there was a base wall of brick which had pivoting panels. And so if you wanted to draw cool air in the early morning, you could tilt those panels, draw the air in. That could then go through the sector of the conservatory that you wanted it to. And then it would go through the louvered openings, which are now windows in the upper part of the tower, through into the octagonal tower itself and out through these vents at this level. So there was constantly fresh air being drawn through the system, so it didn't become like a sort of stagnant bakehouse. Okay, now, one of the things as a design historian I was trying to identify was, where on earth did the idea come from? Now, many of you may have heard that the design was based on the Botanic Garden at Padua, but it's not. It's true that the one at Padua has a circular enclosing wall, but its garden beds within that were set out as effectively ornamental parterres in square plots. And it was a very different size. We looked at every conceivable circular garden with concentric plots, radial plots, everything we could find. And in the end, although it may seem very far-fetched, this diagram here is what I believe inspired Bateman in the finer points of the layout of the garden. And this is a woodcut from a very bizarre book published in Venice in 1499 called the Hypnerotomachia Polyphili, which roughly translates to the strife of love in a dream. And when I say it's bizarre, people are still trying to make sense of it today for a number of reasons. It's a series of fantasies to do with architecture, gardens, travel and love. It's written in a combination of Latin, Greek, medieval Italian, words the author made up, and what purport to be Egyptian hieroglyphics but aren't. But it became famous, really, for the fact that it was very profusely illustrated with woodcuts, illustrating many of these, garden and architectural fantasies. And certainly, although a full English edition didn't come out till 2004, it was fairly well known, and the Bodleian Library at Oxford had a copy of the original edition. Now, the reason I think it's not just because it's, diagrammatically they look similar, that I think this was the inspiration is, this is the woodcut from that publication illustrating the island of Cythera. And Cythera was the home of the goddess of love. And the island was perfectly circular, and it was enclosed with hedges. And as you can see, the pathways were both concentric and radial. Now, probably too small for you to see, but if you get into this point there, there was actually a water circle or a circular river that went around at this point. So then there was an island within the island. And on the island within the island, there was a circular structure which was clad in, not glass, because they couldn't do glass houses on that scale, even in their dreams in the Renaissance, but in alabaster that was described as being as clear as glass. And people with more botanic knowledge than my own have said the description of what was held, that the planting in this garden was effectively almost all the known botany of the time. So in just the same way, McCoy had this desire to present as a living diagram a whole botanic system of the world, a bit ambitious, but that was McCoy, you've got the same thing happening here. Now, I have other reasons for believing that Bateman knew of this design, and that once the idea about a system, and particularly a circular system, was mooted, that he came up with this. So very quickly now to talk about Bateman himself. Polymath sort of seems an understatement, really, for this man. He was very self-effacing, and so he isn't really well known, partly because, say, as an artist, he never signed his works. He would do design work for people and then forbid them to let anybody know that he'd done it. Bit of a nightmare as a researcher, but anyway, you can see there the wide number of fields, and in each of those, he achieved excellence, both in Britain and in Australia. When he came out, initially just for a temporary trip, he came out with a man called William Howitt, who was a prolific English author, brother of Dr. Godfrey Howitt, who many of you will know of. He was coming out to the colony that was administered by his first cousin, Charles Joseph Latrobe. Bateman was a nephew of Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who was the first professionally trained architect in North America. He was the younger brother of John Frederick Bateman, who was the most eminent hydraulic engineer, not just in Britain, but in the world in the 19th century. He had worked with Owen Jones, a famous design reformer in Britain, and was a close friend of the radical early Pre-Raphaelite artists, in particular William Michael Rossetti, Thomas Woolner, and Daddy Gabriel Rossetti, and John Everett Millais. So he'd come from this incredibly, you know, culturally sort of thriving background. People who only know his design in one area tend to think, well, oh yeah, okay, he was good at, he was a good artist, but you know, he was a bit of a sort of aesthete, and you know, but he had all this practical skill as well. So when we get to things like, you know, drainage and surveying and earth movement and all of that, he had his engineering background. He had been a botanical illustrator in Britain before he came out, so he had that sort of knowledge. Really could apply himself to almost anything if he was so inclined. A lot of the time he wasn't. He would start projects and then he'd kind of lose interest and he'd wander off, and his friends would have to physically take him back and sit him down and make him finish the project. So when he came here initially, it was to illustrate William Howitt's books. And so he produced illustrations of scenes in Victoria. This is an example from the Plenty Station, which was owned by the Bakewells, who were related by marriage to the Howitts. And this is the garden shed. Now, the thing is that I'm told by people who've studied these that these belong to, there's a whole set that belong to the National Gallery of Victoria. They got the Royal Botanic Garden staff, somebody there, to come in, and they were able to identify all the plants because such was the meticulous detail. Even when he's doing a large scenic view, he depicted each plant within it. As I say, he was a gifted botanical artist, and here we have a trail of passion flower. Now, that's not, as far as I've been able to establish, a native passion flower. It's the South American banana passion flower. It was a favourite of his, and he used it in interior design and decoration in numerous places. But on the right-hand side, we have this artist's print here of the initial and final or tail piece for the letter B, and these, a full alphabetical set he designed and made for the catalogue of the Public Library of Victoria, which was published in 1861. So at the beginning of each alphabetical list, you would have something like this, and at the end of that section, you would have something like this. Now, in this case, both the upper and lower views are of Ballardiera longiflora, otherwise known as the Purple Mountain Appleberry. And you can see how here he showed it in flower and here in fruit. Now, part of my reason for thinking that he was familiar with the Hypnerotomachia polyphili of 1499 is that it had very distinctive, distinctively shaped foliated initial letters, and the alphabet that he developed for this program is almost identical. So there's 26 plus of these, and they were used, any of you who know the Oxford Companion to Australian Gardens, edited by Richard Aitken, he decided that they would use these initials to head up each chapter in the encyclopedia, so you can find a modern reproduction of them quite easily. Landscape design, he did numerous public parks and gardens here in Victoria. On the left-hand side there is his design for what we now know as the Fitzroy Gardens in East Melbourne. You can see these sort of curvilinear pathways and boundary planting, very characteristic. It's not that he never used geometrical forms. You can see these sort of swathes cut through the foliage at this upper point. But generally, he used these very fluid lines, often sort of teardrop shapes. He was no fool. You might look at this and think, oh, you know, pretty diagram, but what does he know? But it actually responds very well to the topography. The land sloped down from top to bottom and also across diagonally, and through it was Basically a water course, which is to be polite, it was a sewerage ditch really by that stage. But anyway, when they went to lay out the garden, they thought, right, let's make something of that. And the only part really in Fitzroy Gardens now where you get a sense of Bateman is in the Fern Gully. But this was his plan, but it wasn't fully carried out. Now, he also did lots of private gardens in Victoria and also in Britain when he went back after 1869. And this is a very famous fernery in Scotland at a place called Ascog Hall, which he did in the late 1870s. And it's very recently been restored. It was derelict when I first saw it. Now, Northern Hemisphere people occasionally describe it as being a sort of tropical glasshouse. It's not at all. It's a cool, temperate rainforest, the sort of thing we're all very familiar with in this part of the world. It's sunken into the ground, so there's really just a dwarf wall and the roof. It's L-shaped. You go on quite a journey to get through it. So if you're ever in Scotland, the Isle of Bute, just off the coast from Glasgow, get a ferry over and go to the fernery at Ascog Hall. Yes, last slide. Okay, now, what happened to Bateman? Basically, while he was laying out the grounds at a Western District property in 1867, he suffered a serious accident. The owner of the property was driving a buggy too fast. Big accident. Bateman was thrown out, nearly died, right arm paralysed, went to court cases with the Privy Council. Bateman went back to England for the Privy Council case, which he lost, so there he was, back in Britain, absolutely penniless and disabled. He settled on the Isle of Bute and eked out an existence for the next 27 years, mainly with landscape design. And this, these views are not by him, but you can just see him there. That's him. Of the house, every house he settled in, he redesigned and planted the garden off, and he called each one of them the Hermitage. And this is the last Hermitage. You can see here that he never lost his love of plants and gardens and architecture and art and design. And the best description that we have of the garden that surrounded this last hermitage was from no less a person than W.R. Guilfoyle from the Botanic Gardens here in Melbourne. He visited in 1890, left a glowing report, and he said it was a striking example of Bateman's ability as a garden artist. And so on that note of praise from one very gifted garden designer and botanic garden designer of another, I propose to end.
Thank you.
If anybody wants any more information, there's plenty out there.
That was excellent. It's like being Sherlock Holmes, digging into all this history. We've got time for a few questions, and then we'll have our second talk, but there'll be lots of opportunity afterwards because we'll have morning tea and we can talk further. But do we have a few questions to start with?
I'm just interested in the alphabet. Did you always do the sort of the spring version and then the ripening version of the air for all the plants?
No. Where there were very distinctive and attractive forms, he might. In the first version of the catalogue, the 1861 publication, he couldn't always get perfect letter matches for both the beginning and the end. So, for example, for X, he used a form of Exocarpus, which of course begins with E, not X. But then when there was a later edition, he was able to add some new illustrations, get better letter matches and so on. So usually they're of two different plants beginning with the same letter, but just occasionally, like in that case, they belong to the same one.
Didn't he know the Xantharia?
He did use Xantharia, I think, in the next edition, yes.
I can't remember when it was described.
It might be interesting to for the others to know, what are the buildings
Oh, right. He worked quite closely with Joseph Reed, who some of you may know was the university architect for a long time, but also the most eminent Victorian architect in Melbourne, Victorian era architect. He worked as an interior designer with Reed and with other architects, and as an architectural designer, but He wasn't a qualified architect, he didn't see himself as such, so he was sort of working as an associate. So, I mean, you've got houses like Barragunda at Cape Shank, Heronswood at Germana. In terms of that was house and garden for both of those. The earliest garden at Ripponlea, which was largely swept away, unfortunately, in the 1880s by a much more conservative design, that was by Bateman. Probably about a dozen private gardens that we know of and 15 or more in Britain. And they do tend to have common features about them. Oh, I forgot to mention, he did have a scheme for the quadrangle here. Oh. He hoped, of course, the quadrangle would get built as a quadrangle, and we all know it took a very, very, very long time for that to happen. But his idea was that the complete quadrangle would have a fountain in the centre, and that would be surrounded by ferns. So you would have this lovely, cool, moist, green, jewel-like centre to the university. But as we all know, never happened.
Well, Tim and the gardeners have a lovely rainforest, as we see when we walk through the link, so we have got some cool spots there. We will take further questions over a cup of tea. Thank you so much, Anne.